Good afternoon and welcome to everyone. Technology is great until it isn't, right? I am woman, hear me roar. Relax. Not me. Although in the news recently we've been reading and seeing a lot about a very famous athlete that has decided that he would rather be a she. Anyway, what I read to you was the title of an old Helen Reddy song. We looked it up online to make sure the lyrics were actually what I somewhat remembered them to be. No, that was not a song that I related to. What surprised me was the number and types of comments that people had made about the song. Some had totally loved it and were glad that Reddy had finally put their feelings into a song. Some totally despised it and thought it was ridiculous. Some men actually suggested that it was a song that only related to ugly women and that good-looking women never had these problems because they had everything they needed to get a man and have a happy life. And of course, these comments inspired some really caustic comments from some of the women who thought these kinds of men were, well, cavemen. So, are men better than women? Or are women better than men? Today, in this message that's titled The Battle of the Sexes, we'll take a look at how God would answer these questions. And I'm sure we all understand that ideas for messages can come in unusual ways. The idea for this one came when my wife picked up a book at one of the library sales. The book was titled Wild West Women, Travelers, Adventurers, and Rebels. This book is about Canadian woman who, and I'll quote, lived in an era informed by Victorian expectations of what a woman should do and who she should be. And I think we can easily tell from the title of the book that the women whose stories were included in this book were those that didn't meet those expectations. The introduction of the book sets the stage for what life was supposed to be for a woman who lived at that time. Again, I'll quote, if a woman was married, she was expected to do as her husband bade her, to raise the children and to see to the couple's social life. If widowed or abandoned by a husband or unmarried and not supported by her family, and she needed to venture from home to make a living, then she was generally limited to teaching, nursing, or domestic service. Now, I'll add that nursing back then was more along the lines of what an aide would do today, nowhere near the responsibilities or pay that the nurse has today. In 1903, one newspaper produced an article praising the ideal woman. Again, I quote, the ideal woman who had no history and no story was plucked from school before it was too late, much schooling seemingly being the destruction of an ideal woman. Loved but did not reason, while knowing that a man could love more than one woman, loved but one man herself. Sounds to me like men have always been dreamers. Around 1874, a petition was presented to the government, signed by many of the prominent men in Victoria, Canada. The petition said, a woman's rights bill must not be countenanced, for it would interfere with a sacred relationship between men and women and make lovely ladies weak imitations of men. I thought just the introduction to the book summarized a lot of the difficulties that women have had to deal with for centuries. It got me thinking that for far too many men, the only way they feel comfortable with themselves is if the little woman doesn't overstep herself. As long as he can feel that he is better than she is, all is well as good. Legally, in the 19th century, women had almost no rights. They didn't have the right to own property. They didn't have the right to sue or serve on a jury. Well, that's one advantage. They didn't have the right to divorce or even to have custody of their children if the husband divorced her. Their education was inferior to men's, and it ended much earlier. Elizabeth Cady Stanton helped organize the first National Woman's Rights Conference in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848. The goal was to help women obtain some of these rights. Obviously, since women were not allowed to vote at that time, it took the help of men. Men that were not afraid to let women share in the rights that they already enjoyed. Mrs. Stanton was supported in her quest for women's rights by her husband. Many other notable men also joined the cause, including Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. Fortunately, these men with confidence in themselves, men who are willing to acknowledge that a woman could be responsible for her own life, and that man did not have the right to prohibit a woman from going as far as she could. I'd like to refer to a comment made by Steve Myers in a sermon that he gave on, and the title of the sermon was The New Testament on Women. He stated that Jesus didn't see a woman's existence as totally defined by her relationship to a man. Said differently, a woman should not be viewed only as someone's wife, or someone's mother, or someone's daughter, or someone's widow. Jesus saw women as individuals who had personal access to God and could be full-fledged members of his family and his kingdom. So men, married or unmarried, I have another question. How do we see women? Another question for all of us. How does God want us to relate to one another? Let's take a look at Genesis, starting in Genesis 2, verse 7. Genesis 2, verse 7. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. So does this mean that basically men are clods? We know that when woman was created, she was taken from Adam, made from one of his ribs. We see that in verse 21. And the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man." Did that make her inferior because she was made second? No. Eve was specially made, and especially made for Adam. When God created Adam, he knew he was not complete. So he provided him with the perfect solution, a woman to be his wife. James 1, verse 17 tells us that God is the source of every perfect gift. So he knew just how to make the perfect woman. God could have made Eve from clay just as he did Adam. But making her from his rib ensured that they both knew that they were deeply connected and identified with each other. I've read that Martin Luther had noted that God could have used a bone from the toe, which many of us would have assumed that that meant that man was to rule over her. Or God could have used a bone from Adam's head, which would have meant that Eve was to rule over him. But God used a bone from Adam's side, which indicated equality. If God created men and women equal before him, how can they be unequal in man's sight? And all the creatures that God brought to Adam for naming, Adam did not find a companion just like him. The last half of verse 20 tells us that, but for Adam there was not found a helper comparable to him. The word comparable means complementary or supplementary. When a wife is added to her husband, the two of them together should have the entire character and ranges of emotion that God does. God made man to be the leader of the family and woman to be a helper or support. The two together can be a powerful team. Eve was created with intelligence and personality and the same spiritual potential as Adam. That's the same for all women. God always intended for men and women to fill different roles in the family and in the church, but to have the same spiritual potential, and that is to be kings and priests in His kingdom. While the plan may have been for every man to have a wife and therefore every woman to have a husband, we know that that hasn't been the case. The numbers of women who have never had the opportunity to marry are enormous. Whole generations of women have been denied husbands because the men that should have been there to marry them never came back from war. Huge imbalances in the male-female ratio are not uncommon. The important thing is that married or unmarried, men and women are to be growing in many of the same ways as they prepare to become the bride of Christ. I'd like to take some time to look at Proverbs 31. It's often been quoted as describing the ideal woman, even as the metaphor for the bride of Christ. Just considering for our purposes that we're talking about the ideal physical woman, I can think of a few things that are a benefit to all of us, especially us men. And while this is talking about a woman who is a wife, the spiritual applications apply to all women, married or unmarried. Let's look at Proverbs 33, starting in verse 1. I'll get it right eventually. Proverbs 31, verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him, verse 3, do not give your strength to women nor your ways to that which destroy kings. Now this first piece of advice is not to avoid a woman. It's advice not to accumulate a harem, which was often the custom of ancient rulers. She was warning him that such behavior could lead to his destruction. Certainly the example of Solomon showed that. 700 wives and 300 concubines. Absolutely nuts. No ruler would have had time for state business with that number of women that had to be, you pick a word, managed, whatever. Do you think there was peace in that household? Not likely. Although God allowed some men in the Old Testament to have several wives at the same time, that was not His intent from the beginning. How can a man and a wife cleave to each other if there's more than one other? Spiritually, how can we prepare to be the bride of Christ if we're not faithful to Him only? Likewise, the advice continues in verses 4 and 5. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is for the kings. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all afflicted. Again, the advice is that as a leader, he will need to keep a clear head so that he can rule justly. Whether a kingdom or in a home, a man wants to make sure he keeps his drinking under control so he doesn't forget God's laws and risk being abusive, either physically or verbally, to those that he has been designated to protect and guide. Beginning in verse 10, we come to the more familiar part that deals with the ideal woman. What I particularly want us to think about is that this Proverbs 31 wife needs a Proverbs 31 husband. Let's face it, we all can be better at imagining marrying this woman, this marvelous woman, than we are at admitting that this marvelous woman may not want to marry us. Verse 10, who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She's not spending his money frivolously, and she's going to be a supporter of everything that is done for the family. Single men and women also have a responsibility to use their money wisely and prepare for the future. Verse 12. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. While this wife is praised for her faithfulness, her moral worth, and her benefit to her husband, the fact that he trusts her is extremely important. People often live up to our expectations. Often men are inclined to think that only they can make certain decisions. They can tend to think that their opinions are the only valid ones. And occasionally a wife may have made a mistake and is never given a second chance. Good thing for us that God doesn't operate that way. Verse 13, she seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. This isn't a woman, married or unmarried, who is hidden in the background somewhere and not allowed to do anything under her own initiative. And what about unmarried women? If they weren't capable of making something of themselves, who would do it for them? Nowadays, everyone needs to be prepared to stand on their own two feet, like it or not. Verse 14. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. Now today, the food she brings from afar may be only as far away as Trader Joe's, but she does the best she can with what she has. Verse 15. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. Verse 27, she watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. This wonderful woman is not afraid of work. Maybe the items that she seeks are found on Craigslist or the local thrift shop. She's not afraid to take something that might need a little repair work if she can get a good deal on it. She takes care of her family and makes sure that they get off to a good start each day. Now we're getting into some touchy areas where a man has to stay out of her way and trust her ability to handle what she set out to do. Verse 16. She considers a field and buys it. From her profit she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. Now let's put a marker here, but let's go to 1 Chronicles 7:24. Here it's discussing the descendants of Ephraim. Chronicles 7:24. This isn't a woman, married or unmarried, who is hidden in the background, as I said before. 1 Chronicles 7:24. Ephraim had a daughter, married Sherah. She built the towns of Upper and Lower Beth Horon and Uzzen Sherah. Now, I doubt if she physically built the towns, but she undoubtedly oversaw all the workmen that did these two towns. Men, would you allow your wife to have that much autonomy? Would you encourage her to try something without you being involved? Are you single men afraid of a single woman who has already had a successful career on her own and has shown her commitment to God's way? Verse Perhaps it'd be a good idea to consider what an asset she could be to you, if she recognizes you could be an asset to her. Back to Proverbs 31, verse 18. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hand to the distaff and her hand holds a spindle. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. If your wife decided to start up her own business and work diligently at it, would you be able to support her? Would you be jealous if she became more successful than you, bringing in a higher income? We don't need to turn there, but in Acts 16, we see an example of a woman like Lydia. The women are quite competent. It shows that a woman doesn't need a husband to be successful, but if she does have a husband, he needs to be supportive and allow her to be successful. And if a woman has a man behind her who allows them to make most of the decisions, they can do very well. It's not the ideal situation for any woman to be alone, but no woman wants to be married to someone that doesn't give her credit for having some abilities. God expects us to work together in everything that we do. Verse 20. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hand to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all of her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. When your wife has provided well for you and the rest of your family, do you have a problem with her independently helping others? Or does everything that she does have to be run by you first? In other words, men, are we capable of being a Proverbs 31 husband? Or do we tend to be a my way or the highway kind of guy? Verse 28 tells us that not only do this woman's children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also and praises her. One of the resources I looked at was one of our doctrinal study papers entitled The Biblical Role of Women. Summing up Proverbs 31, it includes these comments. Her primary focus is an unwavering devotion to her husband and her family. All the marvelous attributes ascribed to her relate to the fulfillment of her role as wife and mother. She is clearly fully supportive of her husband's position as the family provider and leader by the insertion of the statement, her husband is known at the gates, and all that implies. The entire section of the scripture emphasizes her contribution to the quality of life enjoyed by her family and household. The woman in this chapter sows for her family, pays close attention to the quality and wholesomeness of the food they eat, and generates some additional income that serves to enhance the standard of living and quality of life. Her efforts in this regard appear to be carried out from the home or family setting. Her contribution to the household certainly doesn't match what Aristotle thought. According to Aristotle, the labor of women added no value because, and again I quote, the art of household management is not identical with the art of getting wealth, for the one uses the material which the other provides. The Justice Department task force took a whack at defining the value of housework, and sadly this is only from 1979. The Justice Department came up with the following. The home production that is a woman's primary responsibility is obviously not work. Since no money is paid for the services, it is not only not work, it is valueless. Fortunately, the same year, a young attorney named Michael Minton successfully argued that a housewife was worth more than $40,000 a year. That value is $60,000 or more now. A I guess Aristotle would be surprised to learn just how much a woman does contribute to the household's financial success, whether she works outside the home or is a stay-at-home mother. While many of us feel that we are far short of being a Proverbs 31 wife or husband, what is God really looking for? Returning to Genesis, we can get more understanding of God's attitude toward men and women and their proper relationship. Genesis 1:26. It begins with the instructions, Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. The word for man is better translated mankind in this verse. By this we can see that both Adam and Eve, and consequently all men and women, were made in God's image. Verse 27 confirms this understanding. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. It wasn't just the man who bore the image of God. In verse 28, it says, Then God blessed them, and God said to them, Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. God intended them to work as a team to rule over all creation. Adam's helper. Quoting from the study paper once again, the detailed account of man's creation in Genesis 2, verses 18 to 25, refers to Eve as a helper. The context shows that Eve's role was supportive of Adam's and that his was the leadership role. While God intended the husband to be the leader in the marriage, a support role in no way implies or suggests inferiority, as it is borne out by the fact that both male and female were made in the image of God. The Genesis text further describes Eve as comparable to Adam. The Hebrew word specifically means a counterpart. In other words, she could offer an added dimension of complementary qualities that Adam lacked. The last point is extremely important. We've all heard the statement, behind every good man there's a woman. I am absolutely convinced of the truth of this. It's a rare man that can go far if he doesn't take his wife's suggestions, doesn't seek her opinion, and generally recognize there are things that she gets that he doesn't. Rudyard Kipling stated that a woman's guess is much more accurate than a man's certainty. That can often be the case. When a man recognizes the unique traits that a woman has, he can succeed much better than if he tries to go it alone. We look back at Proverbs 31, verse 23. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. This implies that some of the recognition he receives is in part because of her. There's an old joke about how to be healthy that tells you to make sure you select good parents. Well, obviously, that's impossible. But it is possible to help yourself be a woman who can fulfill all these qualities if the most important thing that a woman can do is to make sure she marries a man that can respect her and that she can respect. It's hard for a woman to submit to a man that she doesn't respect. She can be smarter than he is. She can earn more money than he does. If he makes wise decisions and leads the family well, she can have no problem with either of those facts. But if a woman doesn't respect her husband, her marriage will be miserable. And so then will the husband's. Now, if a man has married somebody smarter than he is and who earns more money than he does, He's already made at least one wise decision. The question will be whether he grows resentful of her or tries to build himself up by bringing her down or by keeping her down. Unfortunately, that happens too often. Hopefully not among us. I'm talking about society in general in this case. The time for couples to seriously consider whether they can love and respect each other comes before they marry. None of us is perfect. We have to make a choice to respect our mate for their strengths and positive traits rather than disrespect them for their faults. When we make that choice, we can help support our relationship rather than weaken it or possibly destroy it. We've probably all heard the name Gary Smalley, who writes and speaks on marriage and family relationships. Back in 1997, Gerald Ost interviewed him for the Good News magazine. He mentioned four things that every man and woman needs in a marriage. I'd like to refer to the first two. First, women need to feel secure and know that they are highly treasured. Second, a wife needs meaningful communication. The husband should not just try to fix what he sees as her problem. He must simply try to understand her needs. We men have this tendency to want to solve problems, even when our wife may just want a sympathetic ear. It's hard not to start telling her what to do, but that can be dangerous. More than likely, she knows what needs to be done. She just wants to talk about it first, perhaps several times, and not only with us, her closest 10 friends. Meanwhile, the most important thing we can do is nothing. And if she asks, "What should I do?" Look interested, but might want to say nothing. Have we ever managed to do that? As a man, we want to do all these big things to show that we're the man. And yet it's often the little things that can build us up in our wife's eyes. Do we pick up the laundry and put it in the hamper? Now, sorry ladies, I can't bring myself to ask whether or not we help wash the laundry. You don't want to see all the clothes gray or pink. Do we leave her things alone? For some reason, women don't seem to like it when we use their good scissors to cut a piece of carpet. Getting back to the Gary Smalley interview, he notes that men's needs are different. Men hate turmoil in their marriages, even though they sometimes provoke arguments. They need rules to live by, so they often create rules in marriage. Women are usually more aware of things in a relationship than men are. They think we are as aware as they are of their needs, which is why it hurts their feelings so much when they find they are not. In the May-June 1997 issue of the Good News, there was a little sidebar that asked the question, "Will your marriage survive?" It began with, "Some marriage counselors claim that couples should learn to fight fairly and not worry about their tendencies to argue. This conventional wisdom is now proving to be not so wise after all. A recent study of 691 couples indicated that the more partners argue, regardless of their style of quarreling, the more likely that they will eventually divorce. The point? Conflicts beget distress, and eventually an argument can be the straw that breaks the camel's back. As mentioned above, men hate turmoil in their marriages, even though they sometimes provoke arguments. Does this mean that women just need to deal with it and learn the things that bother her so that she doesn't upset her husband? Well, of course not. But ladies, you need to remember that we may not be aware of your needs. Help us out a little bit. We're usually just glad to get home from work, have dinner, and then have some time to relax in the evening. It's not that we don't love you, and it's not that we're taking you for granted. It's just that sometimes, hopefully not all time, we're clueless. We husbands can also assume that we're doing the right thing even when we're not. We may be doing a nice thing, but it's not necessarily the needed thing. Simple example, night times can be hectic, where there are dishes to be cleaned up and children to be gotten to bed. A man patting himself on the back may say, "I'll take care of the dishes." Meanwhile, the wife may be craving some time alone, even if it means doing the dishes to get it. In this case, the best thing we could say, "Would you rather me take care of the dishes or the kids tonight?" Is it possible for a woman today to be anything like the ideal Proverbs 31 woman? Probably, but it certainly doesn't happen overnight. When a woman marries, she doesn't instantly know how to manage her home, let alone all the things that this woman is being praised for. Probably a lot of women can remember the first time they fixed a complete meal for company. You may not have gotten everything finished at the same time. It takes time to learn how to get different dishes to be done at the same time. I remember visiting one family back when we were first married, and apparently this was something that this lady never mastered. When something was finished, she set it on the table. When the next item was finished, she put that on the table. And I'm not talking about somebody in a house with only a hot plate. All the burners on her stove worked, and so did the oven. Finally, when everything was done, we sat down to eat. Personally, I'm not fond of cold mashed potatoes with cold gravy. A lot of the traits found in the Proverbs 31 woman and her husband are actually in any of us, married or not. They're developed by doing the same thing, and that is putting God first. If we start our day with prayer and Bible study and set our goals properly, we'll be on the way. Doing this will help us clarify our priorities. To constantly make wise decisions, we need to make sure that we're using the wisdom we can get from God. Bible study is a must. Time management is a must. We need to strive to be diligent and hardworking. We need to be striving to attain moral excellence so that what we do is what is right, even if no one is looking. While the Proverbs 31 woman today could be considered a smart or bargain hunter, as with so many things, the running of the household will go much smoother if both husband and wife are involved. There should be a financial plan that you're both following so that you don't get in trouble with impulse buying. Our lives are full of choices, and wisdom helps us make better ones. Singles also need to make better choices. Just because you don't have anyone else to be responsible to, except yourself, God expects us to spend our money wisely and our time wisely. A Proverbs 31 husband will allow his wife to have her own opinion and express it. He will be proud of his wife's accomplishments, not jealous or resentful. Again, here it is important to make sure that you choose the right person to marry. Personal example, my wife and I both hate to travel, so we have no problem deciding where to go to the feast. But what if she loved to travel? She'd be unhappy to go to Jekyll every year, and I'd be miserable being dragged off to Wisconsin Dells or someplace on the other side of the world. There's some things that are just hard to compromise on, so it's better to know ahead of time so that you don't need to. Mary O'Sigley wrote an article for Vertical Thought that was reprinted in the January-February 2013 Good News entitled "Men and Women of Steel and Velvet." He was addressing the big question for both men and women: when to be like steel and when to show velvet. He gave the example of Abraham, who showed his velvet side in Genesis 13, verse 8 through 12. You may remember this is where Abram, as he was called back then, gave his nephew Lot the right to choose where he would dwell, since they could no longer dwell together because of the number of animals that they had. Verse 8. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, for we are brethren. If you take the left, I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan and journeyed east. And Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan. This land was a lot more arid and mountainous, so it was a sacrifice for Abraham. Later, he applied his steely side. In Genesis 14, verse 14, we read, "Now when Abram heard that his brother," his nephew actually, "was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants and went in pursuit." Verse 16, "So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people." What about Esther? She showed her velvet side by, quote, "humbly accepting advice from the palace eunuch. She displayed grace and a modest beauty that won the king's heart." But Esther's inner steel came into play when she first had to align herself with her people. She had to courageously approach her husband and work things out so her people were saved and their enemies were the ones that were defeated. And of course, the greatest example of a man of steel and velvet was Christ himself. His care and concern for those that were suffering was amazing. On the other hand, when he dealt with the money changers in the temple, we're looking at pure steel. Can we learn when to be soft and yielding and when to be strong and solid? With practice and submitting our wills to God, we can. While learning to esteem others better than ourselves, as Philippians 2:3 tells us, we can. Now, this is not a scripture that we're trying to master only in our dealings with others in our church or at work in our neighborhood. It's a prescription for a happy marriage and for good relationships within the church, whether we're single or married. One thing about the Proverbs 31 is that her appearance is never mentioned. It was her character that was important. How many men ignore the fact that there are things about a woman that just don't set right with him because she is just so attractive he can't get past her looks? We have a trivet in our home that says, "Kissing don't last, cooking do." Looks eventually fade. Gravity starts to be our enemy. All of us need to be praying that we're getting lovelier on the inside and that our spouse's eyesight is failing. We should have the happiest marriages in the world. We understand the spiritual reasons for marriage and have more understanding of the role of the man and woman in marriage. Men and women do have different personalities, different strengths and weaknesses. As such, we need to learn to work together rather than letting our God-given differences separate us. God wants us, male and female, to be in His kingdom. What can a man or woman do to help each other reach their potential? Well, I'll mention two things. There are, of course, many more. First, as I said before, put God first. Married or unmarried, this is where it starts for all of us. While a husband and wife can give each other a hand on their journey to the kingdom, ultimately we will need to stand before God. We will all be judged on our own merits. 1 Peter 3:7 reminds us, 1 Peter 3:7. Husbands dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. It's not only us men that are being called. If we're not encouraging and supporting our wives, and all the women that are making this Christian journey on their own, could we be hindering our relationship with God? And second, we need to love and respect each other. One way to practice love and respect for your wife is to allow her to share in how the family's money is spent, and to have some of her own money to use as she wishes. 1 Timothy 5:8, Paul gives some advice to Timothy. 1 Timothy 5:8. But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. If finances are tight, both husband and wife need to sacrifice, not just the wife or the wife and children. If you are married, help your wife be prepared to carry on in the event of your death, especially while the children are young. She should be encouraged to know how to deal with family finances. She should have her own credit card and checking account so that she can be establishing credit on her own. If you're a single woman, you need to make sure that your finances are in order and you have arrangements for someone to be your power of attorney and healthcare surrogate if the need ever arises. Eve was not given to Adam to be a slave or subordinate, even though she was to submit to him. In any marriage, we have to learn to work together, show respect to each other, and to love each other. That approach follows the familiar biblical principles that can be found in Ephesians 5, verse 22 and 25. A lot of men's favorite verses. The wife is to submit, not because she's inferior, but because there can only be one head. What we need to remember is that we are different, but we can benefit from our differences so that we're both stronger in the long run. Men can be more analytical. After all, facts are more measurable. Therefore, a man's tendency can be to only trust what he sees. Women can be much more intuitive. Ministers and all men can be far better counselors because of their wives. A woman brings feminine insight, and they're often better at analyzing people. They help bring a focus on people rather than objects, and on feelings rather than actions. Combining our strengths when an important decision needs to be made can help lead us to make a better decision. In the January-February 1999 issue of Good News, there was some interesting data that came from a study done by researchers at Carnegie Mellon University. These researchers put some common assumptions to the test about sex differences in communication. In comparing the effects of male-male, female-female, and male-female discussions, they found that people listened better to others of their own sex, but noted that more emotional support was provided during opposite-sex interactions than during same-sex interactions. In establishing marriage as a male-female relationship, God gave humanity the best foundation for emotional support. As with so many things, what started out as a desire for women not to be treated as a personal property for men has led to consequences far beyond what Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were looking for. The feminist movement basically wants to remove all traces of male dominance within a family. Or if there had to be a man in the house, the idea was to make sure that he was the ideal match. And of course, that can be determined by living together before marriage. Except that it doesn't work that way. After decades of rejecting the traditional marriage relationship, the results have not been what some thought they would be. Rather than providing the benefits of marriage without the so-called problems, cohabitation brings the problems without the benefits of a good marriage. In a national survey of married couples and unmarried living together, men in unmarried relationships scored lower on commitment than anyone else in the survey. And not only is there less physical commitment without being married, there's less emotional commitment. But is it any surprise when you ignore biblical-based roles for husbands and wife that it doesn't work? Marriage involves commitment, self-sacrifice, a willingness to share. It pictures faithfulness and permanence. These are things that we all need to be learning. Why do we refuse to acknowledge that God knows what's best for us? Marriage, if at all possible, a solid respect for one another, support for one another, and caring for one another more than we care for ourselves. God is the ultimate authority on marriage. He knows that it takes a certain level of sacrifice and service for it to work well. Sacrifice and service from both the man and the woman. But he also knows there's a divine purpose in marriage. And if we understand that purpose and commit to it, it puts the petty differences that are common in all marriages, into perspective. The November-December 2003 Good News included a sidebar titled "The Ultimate Goal of Marriage Union." A marriage union has an ultimate purpose that few understand. The Apostle Paul gives us a glimpse of this truth when he wrote, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." That was taken from Ephesians 5:31. Continuing, in Revelation 19:7-9, Jesus Christ revealed that in the future, at his return to earth, he will marry the church, the believers who have been faithful to him and his word. Today's physical marital union depicts tomorrow's greater spiritual union between Christ and his church. Some Christians are now preparing for and actively part of the future permanent union. The spiritual growth of a Christian is the very process of proving ourselves ready for the ultimate goal of marriage to Christ, to be one with him, resurrected to spirit as he is spirit. The Church of God is now betrothed to Christ, which means the church is promised to him as a virgin bride. Since human beings cannot make themselves pure, we are made clean by Jesus' sacrifice and saved by his life. However, with God's assistance through his Holy Spirit, we are still required to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. So what about those who have never married or who are not presently married? Whether one marries or remains single, God wants us to understand that there are spiritual implications to the marriage relationship. Physically married or unmarried, the requirements are the same. We are to be preparing now to marry Christ at his return. And what will Christ be looking for in his bride? First of all, the same thing that we look for in a mate: someone that will be faithful. Time and again we read that Israel was not faithful. Eventually God had to set her aside. God is not going to marry a bride who is not totally faithful and committed to Him and His way. He doesn't want us to go off making friends with the world and its ways, which is basically committing spiritual adultery. He's looking for someone that's faithful in everything they do. Someone whose whole life is committed to His way of life, keeping the Sabbath, the holy days, tithing, and His laws. Someone who is faithful in doctrine and the handling of small responsibilities we've been given now, running our homes, building loving relationships, and keeping God first and foremost in our lives. We need to remain faithful to God, His law, His way of life, His approach, and His values. God is also looking for a mate with character. For starters, we can read Philippians 2, verse 5. We all know it. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. That tells us we need to have the mind of Christ. That's where our godly character is going to start. Having this type of mind doesn't happen overnight. It's an approach that will take us time to internalize. The fruits of the Spirit are all characteristics of God that we need to be developing, and these too take time. We are ultimately to have the very nature and character of God. We need to start now by learning to discern right from wrong. We start now by taking the law of God and applying it in our lives and everything that we are faced with. One day we will be assisting Christ as salvation is offered to the entire world. Christ would not have a wife who doesn't support Him and who isn't faithful to Him. So yes, the ideal might be for a man and woman to marry, since they could probably learn some of these spiritual concepts faster by submitting to one another. But the responsibility to prepare to be the bride of Christ rests on each one of us, whether we're single or married. Men, women, single, married, being faithful and having a strong character are among the things that Christ is looking for in His bride. And where are we going to learn how to be the future wife that He will marry? Not only through marriage now, but also in our day-to-day lives and how we conduct ourselves. Do we do it the same way that Christ did when He walked on this earth? Christ won't marry a child. We need to make sure that we're grown up and mature so that we're ready to marry Christ. In conclusion, let's look at Revelation 19, verses 7 and 8. Revelation 19, verse 7. Let us be glad and rejoice and give Him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and His wife has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And He said to me, write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. We have been called to be the very bride of Christ. Now is our time to grow and mature and make ourselves ready for when Christ returns. God looks at each of us as the future bride of His Son, and everything we go through now is part of what He is doing to help us prepare to be that part of that bride. So are men better than women? Are women better than men? Well, God doesn't look at it that way. He made us both in His image and plans for all of us to be in His kingdom. It doesn't matter if we're male or female, married or single, there is to be no battle of the sexes. Okay.